Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Kicking with Kiro here on Full Press Radio, episode number 126. Thanks for kicking with me, Ricky Keeler, here on a Saturday, and it is Super Wild Card Weekend. The playoffs are here. I'm excited. I hope you're excited, too. We got 6 games, 2 today, 3 tomorrow, 1 Monday. I like Monday night playoffs. It kind of goes really well. So we'll look at those 6 games, break them down, preview them, give you my rankings of out of the 6, what's the best game, what's the worst game on the slate. We'll go over the Black Monday coaching firings and really some that were head-scratching, some that were just obvious. We'll go over the national championship. Georgia, of course, finally conquering the demon that was Alabama. What does it mean for college football going forward? We'll touch on a couple other things as well. I want to remind you can follow me on Twitter, at Rickinator555. Follow us on Twitter, at FP_coverage, at Full Press Radio. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You're at your podcast. Just search Kicking with Keeler. Chances are that's where you'll find the show. And I want to hear from you. Tell me what you like, what you don't like. You can email me, rickjkeeler@gmail.com. I'm always happy to hear from you. Remember, download the Full Press Coverage app on your iOS or Android device. It is free. All of our articles are there. All of our podcasts are there. Live shows. Miss any part of the show. Or you just want to hear me talk again. I'm always happy to do that. So again, be sure to download the Full Press Coverage app today. We greatly appreciate it. So we'll go over the playoffs in the second segment. What I want to do in this segment to start off is I want to talk about the coaching firings across the league. And there are a lot of openings. A lot of openings right now in the league. And I think there are a couple that are head-scratching, and I'll dive into those specifically. Some really that are not that much of a surprise. It starts really, we'll go over one by one. The Bears letting go of Matt Nagy, letting go of their GM, Ryan Pace. That was the way to go for Chicago. It was a foregone conclusion Matt Nagy was going to lose his job. They had to find the best coach to help Justin Fields. You drafted Fields with the first-round pick. You gave up a first-round pick this year to make it happen. So you have to do everything you can to make that work for Fields. Nagy didn't really do anything with Trubisky. Got to the playoffs, but one time. Actually, 2 times, but not really much to write home about. So Matt Nagy moves on. Bears will look for their new coach right now. Denver with Vic Fangio. I think they have underachieved. They're in a tough division, yes, but the offense is still lacking there. So whatever Denver gets a quarterback, and there's a common thing you're seeing with the Broncos. They're going to interview the Packers offensive coordinator Nathaniel Hackett, interviewed the quarterback's coach and passing game coordinator Luke Getsy. Kind of shows you a common theme. Remember, Aaron Rodgers, one of those teams rumored in the offseason that he would be interested in going to is Denver. So maybe the Broncos try to go that direction, although they're looking more at offensive candidates for their head coaching position, but the Packer connection is just really hard to ignore. The Jaguars, we all know about their position. Urban Meyer being out, we'll save that. Vikings get rid of Mike Zimmer and their GM, Rick Spielman. Vikings just underachieved. When you look at that team, you've got Dalvin Cook, Justin Jefferson. I know Adam Thielen was banged up this year, but Adam Thielen's still there. But what was Mike Zimmer's calling card? Defense. Viking defense really didn't do much down the stretch. And for a team that had the offensive talent to make the playoffs, Kirk Cousins actually had a pretty good season. And you can understand why Minnesota said, you know what, it's time, we need to start over. Rick Spielman did build a team that got to the NFC Championship a few years ago with Case Keenum, but the Vikings kind of need a refresher, so it makes sense that they would move on in both directions. The Giants, I mean, what can you say about the Giants, really, that hasn't already said? They're a mess, and it all goes down to ownership. I mean, being in New York here, I'm in the New York area, and it used to be the Jets were the embarrassment of the two football teams because they were dysfunctional, not being able to get any decisions right. Now that's the Giants. Because of bad personnel decisions. And it goes down to Dave Gettleman, who did retire as GM. But Dave Gettleman took Saquon Barkley with the second pick in the draft. That has not worked. When they could have taken a guy like Josh Allen, a quarterback at 2. Yes, it's revisionist history. But you also took Daniel Jones with the 6th overall pick. And Daniel Jones has been okay, but he's not been worth the 6th overall pick. So when you miss on those two things, it's going to hurt your franchise. You could fix the offensive line all you want. It's still a work in progress there. They bring in Kenny Galladay, wide receiver, and not his fault because the offense had so many injuries and COVID and all that stuff. He didn't have a touchdown this year. And Joe Judge tries to talk like a head coach. He doesn't act like one. I mean, the embarrassment the Giants did where they were running QB sneaks from their own 4-yard line at back-to-back plays against Washington last week was a joke. It was the laughing stock of the league. Yes, you're starting Jake Fromm and Mike Glennon, but it's partially your fault why you're starting Mike Glennon and Jake Fromm, because you don't have any good backup quarterbacks, and that's on the GM, and it's on the head coach. Joe Judge wasn't ready to be a head coach. Yes, he only got 2 years. I know John Mayer would have probably wanted to see the plan go longer, but you couldn't. Because ever since the report came out from Adam Schefter and a bunch of New York writers a few weeks ago that Joe Judge was safe, the Giants continually embarrassed themselves. And it was kind of shocking they went all day Monday without firing him and waited until Tuesday afternoon to fire him. What the Giants need going forward is an established head coach. They need somebody that's not learning on the job in New York. Because one of the things that's hard to do, and ask any first-time head coach in any of the major sports here in New York, it's learning on the job. Ask Aaron Boone that, who continues to win the Yankees, but people rip on him because he doesn't win a world championship. Ask Luis Rojas with the Mets how tough that is. Ask Robert Saleh, who haven't had a decent year for the Jets, all things considered, but I'm sure it's tough learning on the job in New York for him. Ask David Quinn with the Rangers before he got canned. It is very tough to win as a first-year head coach. You got to deal with the media. You got to deal with the expectation. And everything gets magnified. And you have to accept that when you take that kind of job. So for the Giants, what do? You obviously first have to look for GM. And Joe Schoen, the Bills assistant GM, is probably the favorite. And one of the things I'm just surprised about in this cycle is where's the interview for Lewis Riddick? Lewis Riddick was a hot candidate over the last couple of years interviewing for GM positions. All of a sudden, now you can't get a GM interview. I'm really surprised by that. Maybe he's waiting until after Monday night's game when he's done with his broadcasting duties for ESPN. I have no clue. But that's been kind of surprising. So, again, if I'm the Giants, I want an established head coach. I don't need an established head coach that's worried about the quarterback because, again, I don't know what Daniel Jones' future is. I'm not exactly invested in Daniel Jones because you don't know if the GM is going to be. Yes, it's a weak quarterback class, but the GM also has to buy in as well. So I think the Giants situation is different from a bunch of these other spots because the Vikings, you have only Kirk Cousins for one more year. It's a little different. The Bears, you're appealing to the young quarterback, essentially. Denver's different because you don't know who your quarterback is next year. In Jacksonville, you got to appeal to Trevor Lawrence. So in a way, you've got to work to Fields and Lawrence in those cases. You don't have to do that here with the Giants. Which leads you to the two questionable firings of the cycle. And, of course, Vegas is looking for a head coach, but Rich Pisacci, I think, has at least earned another interview. And maybe there's a chance to move the interim tag, especially if Vegas beats the Bengals today. How do you not bring him back? I don't know, but it's Mark Davis. They could go for a big name. Maybe Jim Harbaugh gets involved. Who knows? But Miami was shocking on Monday morning to find out Brian Flores is getting fired. And you read all the reports. You read that he had arguments with Tua. There's the Michael Lombardi report that he said we took Mac Jones. There's a report today by Adam Schefter that Brian Flores wanted the Dolphins to get Deshaun Watson. Stephen Ross, the owner, said no. And normally in any sport, you take the quarterback over the head coach. Because you have more invested in the quarterback. And this seems like Brian Flores is the scapegoat for Chris Greer taking Tua Tagovailoa over Justin Herbert. Because you look at the pattern with Flores. Remember, Tua missed part of a game in the Thursday night game against Baltimore with an injury where he was okay but not okay enough to play. Jacoby Brissett gets hurt and then in comes Tua. Flores and Tua have had a rocky relationship. That's clear. Go back to last year when the Dolphins were keep plugging Tua and Ryan Fitzpatrick. Like, going back and forth with each guy. Has Tua had received the confidence from the Dolphins? Probably not. I mean, last week against the Patriots, Tua's barely thrown for over 100 yards. And they have Jalen Waddle there. They have Mike Gesicki. They have Devontae Parker. They have weapons there where you can throw the football. That's a given. But one of the things you're seeing with the Dolphins is there just seems to be a lack of direction right now between the team and the front office. Remember, 2 years ago, everybody thought the Dolphins were going to tank and they're going to go 0-16. And Brian Flores did a fantastic job of getting that team to overachieve and building a foundation, bringing a Patriot way, which, in all fairness to Bill Belichick, is his assistants and people that have coached under have done bad jobs across the league. But Flores, to have a 500 record in 3 years in a weird situation in Miami, is an accomplishment. Remember, he beat Belichick 3 out of the last 4 times. So it's not as if this coach hasn't found a way to beat New England, swept them this year. Probably cost New England the division because he swept them. So you lose that. Lose a coach that almost took you to the playoffs a year ago. And has Tua earned that much equity in Miami? So the question now is, where do you go for your head coach? Do you go offense? Stay in the division with Brian Daboll, Kellen Moore? Or are you getting just another defensive coach like a Dan Quinn, who would be not similar, not quite Brian Flores, but similar? How much is Miami willing to appease the quarterback? Because to me, it's more on the front office. Why the Dolphins didn't make the playoffs this year. Because how could you fire a coach? If you're going to fire Brian Flores, you fire him when they were 1-7. The second he wins 8 of his last 9 games in the season, it looks bad when you fire him. Unless it just got really, really bad behind the scenes. Which, from all sounds like it, all the indications are, it sounds like it did. But that's just a weird situation in general. And probably the weirdest situation is Houston. And I know the optics are bad, and we can get into this and have a whole other debate about the lack of black head coaches in the NFL. Mike Tomlin's the only black head coach. There are a couple minority head coaches. You feel bad for David Culley because he took that job, and that Texans team was projected to win maybe 2 games. They end up winning 4. They essentially knocked the Chargers out of the playoffs. They were down 21-0 to Tennessee last week, rallied to make it a 3-point game. Davis Mills at least has earned another year at quarterback, and that team had zero talent. Had a lack of talent. And David Culley, a lifelong assistant head coach, took it as his one opportunity. And maybe Nick Caserio feels he can land Brian Flores. Maybe he wants to try to get Gerard Mayo and bring more of the Patriot way there. Remember, there's still the influence of Jack Easterby in Houston. So then why'd you hire him? If you're going to hire David Culley knowing you're going to fire him after 1 year, maybe David Culley kind of knew that going in. That's still a bad look for the Texans, man. And it's hard for any coach to establish anything in 1 year. Especially when you go to a team that has little talent in the cupboard, where you're probably going to win 2, 3, 4 games and have to start over. When you have a quarterback that can't play due to legal issues in Deshaun Watson, what was Culley supposed to do? What was any coach supposed to do? That's why nobody wanted that job last year. Because they didn't know what was going on. If you had Deshaun Watson and he was healthy and you could have a good season in a winnable division. Even though Tennessee finishes with the best record in the AFC, you could argue that they could have had more challenges from people thought Jacksonville could maybe win a few more games, or that Houston, if they had Watson, could win a few more games, or Indianapolis with their disappointment of a season the way it ended. But the Texans job is one where I think you're going to have to really dig deep into how you blend in with the front office, how you blend in with Caserio, and who is the right coach to lead you long term, because you can't afford firing guys every 2-3 years. It doesn't work. It makes you look like you don't have a stable franchise. Look at the Giants. Do you want to be like the Giants? Who have, again, have become a laughing stock in the NFL. Because they haven't drafted well. At least offensively. They haven't picked the right coaches. They need to pick a coach and a GM to work together. So the Texans situation, I get it. We can change the Rooney Rule. We can do all these things all you want. and I understand the optics are terrible. I want to look at the Texans situation as more, though, how do you find the coach that leads you long-term? And if you don't believe David Culley's your long-term guy, sure, you could give him one more year to try it out. I think he'd at least deserve that. I think he at least deserved a chance to get the most talent around him as possible. But you could also argue that, hey, if Caserio wants Flores, and Flores is going to get fired, as nobody did, then you could have the right to make a decision. So that's the, it'll be the interesting part of this coaching cycle. It'll develop over the next few weeks. More people will become available. More interviews will happen. And as the hirings go, we will progress with those and talk about them on the show. So coming up next, week 17, or week 18 thoughts, including what the heck happened in Vegas. And I should say, what the heck happened in Jacksonville. And then we'll rank our top six games. There are only six games today, but how would I rank the six matchups for Wildcard Weekend? And then we'll do word association in our third segment as well. Stay tuned. Coming up next, we will look back at the final week of the regular season. Look ahead to the start of the playoffs today here on Kicking with Keeler on Full Press Radio. Looking back at Week 18 in the NFL and looking ahead to Super Wildcard Weekend beginning today here on Kicking with Keeler. Ricky Keeler back with you. And, of course, what everyone wants to talk about from Week 18 is the Chargers-Raiders finish to the day. And, to me, that was a fun game. And once the unthinkable happened, that the Jaguars have beaten the Colts, which I'm still stunned by. Jacksonville played their best game of the season, but Indianapolis fell flat on their face, and particularly Carson Wentz. And you had the GM, Chris Ballard, come out this week and said, well, nothing's guaranteed for next year. It kind of is, though. You give up a first-round pick to get this guy. And you have to do everything you can, I think, to make it work with Carson Wentz. But to be fair, what's been the criticism about Carson Wentz? Big game situation. Can he deliver? Remember, Nick Foles has the championship. Yes, Wentz has a ring and helped Philly get to the one seed. But because Wentz got hurt, Nick Foles gets credit for the playoff run to the championship. Carson Wentz doesn't have that. He kind of has to build up that equity. And amongst Colts fans, when you have Jonathan Taylor and you have a good offensive line and you have a defensive line with Darius Leonard and the way that team can go. Yes, they had injuries in the secondary that I think kind of hurt them in that game. Or Trevor Lawrence, those two touchdowns, doesn't throw an interception. But to score 11 points against the Jaguars in a game you have to win, Indianapolis is going to be thinking about that one for a long time, because if they had made the playoffs, remember, they had beaten New England a few weeks ago, beaten Arizona on the road, and then lost to Vegas and Jacksonville where they needed one win to get in. Just one. If they got in, they would have been one of the tougher outs in the playoffs because they can run the ball and they can play defense. So disappointing. So once Indy loses, once Pittsburgh somehow beats Baltimore in one of the uglier games of the week, but the Steelers find a way to win in overtime, then the scenario we had talked about all week came into play. The Jaguars beat the Colts, Steelers beat the Ravens, the Chargers and Raiders, all they had to do was tie to get into the playoffs. The Raiders had a 15-point lead. It looked like all for naught. Brandon Staley looked like a dummy for going for it on 4th-and-1 from his own 18-yard line. Which I'm still convinced Brandon Staley just wants to prove he's smarter than everybody else, and it just doesn't work when you try to do that. But Justin Herbert rising down the field. They make like 10 fourth-down conversions, at least what felt like 10. They tie the game, get to overtime. So I'm watching the game with my brother, watching a couple things. And I said, watch, both teams are going to kick a field goal. Raiders go down, kick a field goal. Chargers drive down the field, they kick a field goal. So it's 32-32. And at that point, I'm thinking, you know what? If you're Vegas, get a couple first downs. You don't have to play for the win. Then you're in the playoffs. Now, there is still that competitive nature, and you understand that. You want to be the one that ultimately gets a victory. So the Raiders are driving down the field. They get it to about the inside L.A. territory. And it's clear when you're watching the Raiders, they run it on first down. And they run it again. Chargers wind down the clock, get it to about 40 seconds, and then call timeout. Now, Staley said after the game it's because he had to get some substitutions, get the best run defense out there. But at that point, if you're Brandon Staley, your Chargers' run defense has been bad all year anyway. You've got to think in the situation there. Now, we don't know if Bisacci is telling the truth that they were actually going to let the clock run down and take the tie. But if he stops them on third down and it's 4th and 3, 4th and 2, are you punting it? Are you going for it and running the ball? Or are you kicking a 58-yard field goal and risking it getting blocked? We'll never know. But Staley gets a lot of criticism for the timeout, and it is warranted. I think the 4th and 1 deserves more criticism. But Staley, one of the problems is he reads too much of the numbers and doesn't read the situation. And as a good coach, and you're in this day of analytics, you still have to do both. And it just seemed like he didn't have a right feel. You still need good feel to be a coach in addition to the numbers and the stats and all that fun stuff. So the Chargers are going home, and that's a disappointment because I know everybody wanted to see Justin Herbert in the postseason. With that offense, with Eckler, with Keenan Allen, with Mike Williams emerging, they were the team that I think people wouldn't want to see either. They're out. How about the Niners? Great comeback by them against the Rams, and we'll talk about Matthew Stafford a little bit later and why I don't trust him at all, but give Jimmy Garoppolo credit. Drives him down the field, gets a touchdown to tie it in regulation, and then after the Robbie Gould kicks a field goal about under 3 minutes left in overtime, San Francisco moves on, Saints go home, but honestly, the Niners, I wouldn't say deserved it more than the Saints, but once Taysom Hill gets hurt in week 18, Trevor Siemian has to come in. Who really wanted to watch the Saints play in the playoffs? I know Sean Payton did a fantastic job and is probably a Coach of the Year candidate anyway. But if were you going to really sit down and watch Trevor Siemian against, let's say, the Rams defense or the Cowboys defense? Well, the matchup I think would actually have been Tampa's defense, and the Saints have beaten them both times this year. But still, the matchup would have been ugly. It would have been Kamara and the Saints defense trying to keep it close. Still a heck of a year. New Orleans, I would hope, will look for a quarterback this offseason and try to find one because they're not that far away from contending again. Especially with Sean Payton at the helm. But the Niners make it. Buffalo wins the AFC East, which was no surprise. It was kind of a surprise to see New England struggle against Miami as bad as they did. Rams win the NFC West. Arizona with a stinker against the Seahawks. I'm shocked Arizona's so bad at home. But the problem for the Cardinals, when you look at that game, Seattle was 8 for 12 on third down. 8 for 12, and they ran for 200 yards. There's a Seahawks team, remember, that doesn't have Chris Carson. It's basically allowed 200 yards to Rashad Penny. That's not going to get it done if you want to beat the Rams on Monday. So let's look at the wild card. And again, we'll go 6 through 1. 6 being the game I least want to watch and is the least attractive. 1 being the game that's most attractive. Number 6 is sadly the Sunday night game tomorrow night. Steelers and the Chiefs. And this could be Ben Roethlisberger's last game. The Chiefs are 12.5-point favorites. Kansas City beat Pittsburgh 36-10 a few weeks ago. And keep in mind, there was no Travis Kelce in that game. Tyreek Hill was just coming off of COVID. And KC still blew the doors off of them. Harrison Butker was out, the kicker. Steelers have done all they could. But here's the problem if you're Pittsburgh. To beat the Chiefs, they've got to score at least 20 points. And the last time the Steelers, you look at their last few weeks, they did score 20 against Cleveland week 17. Then they hadn't scored 20 in a game since the week against the Vikings on December 9th. And mostly that was because of their second half surge. Remember, they were awful in the first half in that game. I don't think the Steelers can ask Ben Roethlisberger to throw the ball as much as they have this year. He's thrown it over 600 times, which is still insane. This is going to have to be a Najee Harris run the ball and make Patrick Mahomes sit on the sideline. But I think the Chiefs have enough to still score quickly. Yes, no Clyde Edwards-Helaire and Darrell Williams is questionable. They can run the football. We've seen that this year. Williams against the Steelers a few weeks ago, 11 carries, 55 yards. So there is an option to run the football. Pittsburgh does have TJ Watt. It can get pressure. But I still think as much as the Steelers will try to make this a game, I just don't think they have enough firepower on offense to make that happen. Even though with Deontay Johnson and Chase Claypool, there are weapons. But their offense hasn't really shown they can put it together for 4 quarters, which you need to do against Kansas City. So that's number 6. Number 5. is the Eagles-Bucks game. Yes, this game is going to be in a monsoon tomorrow afternoon. But I just don't think the Eagles have that much in the tank. And maybe I'm wrong, and I've heard people tell me the Eagles have a good chance to win. You got the number one rushing offense in the Eagles against the number one rush defense in the Bucks. And you look back at that Week 6 meeting earlier this year. Yes, Tampa Bay won by 6, but that was largely because Philly rallied back in the fourth quarter. Leonard Fournette and the Buccaneers controlled that game. Now, Fournette, coming off the hamstring injury, we'll see how effective he is. And there is no Ronald Jones, but that still gives opportunities for Le'Veon Bell, Keyshawn Vaughn. Like, Tampa can run the football. And yes, Tom Brady doesn't have Antonio Brown anymore, doesn't have Chris Godwin, doesn't have Cyril Grayson. He's got Mike Evans. He's got Gronk. He's got Scotty Miller, who can play maybe a little magic from last year. Breshad Perriman, Cameron Brate, O.J. Howard. There are options for Brady. And yes, the rain and the weather will make it a little bit tougher to throw the ball, but in a monsoon, who do you trust more, Tom Brady or Jalen Hurts making his playoff debut? Probably would lean toward Tom Brady. Is this Tampa team as good as last year? No, they're good enough to win this week. So that's the number five game. Number four is this afternoon's game, 4:30, Raiders, the Bengals. This is a fun matchup between Derek Carr and Joe Burrow. Burrow, of course, the breakout season this year, coming off the injury a year ago. Carr, a great story of being a great leader and leading his team to the postseason with his talent down the stretch. Derek Carr has thrown at least, first time he threw multiple touchdowns last week since early December. And you go back to that first matchup earlier this year, the Bengals beat the Raiders in Vegas 32-13 in a game that was 13-6 going into the fourth quarter. So Vegas can keep this close. They can get to Joe Burrow. Burrow was sacked 3 times in that game. But Joe Mixon really was the big story. 30 carries, 123 yards, and 2 touchdowns. So in a game where you look at the quarterbacks, running back's going to be the key, too, between Josh Jacobs and Joe Mixon. But this is a fun matchup because I think both these teams can put points on the board. Darren Waller's only getting healthier for Vegas. I just don't know if it's good compared to the other three games. That's why I have it number four. Number three is the game tonight. Patriots at the Bills. Buffalo continues to move up in the spread. It's now 5 as we do this show. And this is round 3. Patriots, of course, won the matchup in early December when it was windy and cold. And it's going to be less than 10 degrees at kickoff tonight. Wind, not as much as the matchup in December in Buffalo, where the Bills, ironically enough, are not built to play in Buffalo. But you go back to week 16, and in that game, the Bills didn't punt, kept getting third down conversions, dominated the Patriots' defense, was 33-21. Mac Jones threw a couple interceptions. So what game are you getting this week? Can a Patriot team that's without its left tackle Isaiah Wynn, that's without its number two corner Jalen Mills, without Sean Wade, so you're without 2 corners. This is a Bills team that has Stephon Diggs, Gabriel Davis, Cole Beasley, Emmanuel Sanders. Can the Bills passing attack do well in 0-degree weather? Can this Patriot defense, which has been awful through the last 4 weeks, allow Duke Johnson to run for 100 yards last week? Can they get pressure? Can they keep Josh Allen in the pocket? Can they make Josh Allen throw the ball down the field? Remains to be seen. And can Mac Jones win a game where everybody knows the Patriots are going to run the ball with Damian Harris, Ramondre Stevenson, Brandon Bolden? If the Patriots are trailing in the fourth quarter in a close game, can Mac Jones lead them to a win on the road? I don't think that's a given, and I don't think it's realistic to expect that. And again, this is a Patriot fan talking here that where I don't think tonight is an indictment on where Mac Jones can go in his career because I just don't think he's ready yet to win this kind of a game. This is a pressure-filled game for Josh Allen. He has to win this game. Because if the Bills lose to New England, despite winning the division, it's going to be an embarrassment of a year for them because they were supposed to go to the AFC Championship game. Still, with the intrigue of the coaching chess match between Belichick and McDermott, what this game could be in terms of low scoring, close down to the wire, I like this game a lot. That's number three. Number two is the game in the mid-window, Sunday afternoon, 4:30, an old classic 1990s rematch, Niners-Cowboys in Dallas. The pressure for Mike McCarthy to win a playoff game, because if he loses this one, you wonder how hot his seat gets. Can Dak Prescott finally get Dallas on a deep run in the postseason? And for the Niners, they've got nothing to lose. Jimmy Garoppolo is playing for a contract because he's not the future in San Francisco. They can run the football with Elijah Mitchell and Deebo Samuel. They've got the weapons. They've got the defense. I mean, this game should be close and come down to the wire. And all the pressure is on Dallas. There's really none on San Francisco. They rallied to get into the postseason. But they have the formula to beat the Cowboys unless Dallas becomes more balanced on offense. So that's number two. And number one, the game to end it all. Monday night, the Cardinals and the Rams on ESPN, ABC, all that good stuff. And to me, the quarterback matchup is so intriguing. You have a Cardinal team that's lost once on the road this year, and that was to the Lions. Who did play better down the stretch, but that's still an embarrassing one road loss that would have prevented that prevents a 9-0 road record. Kyler Murray on the road this year, 15 touchdowns, 3 interceptions. And Arizona dominated the Rams earlier this year, albeit the Rams won the recent matchup in Arizona. No DeAndre Hopkins. We'll see if Christian Kirk and that passing attack, Zach Ertz, can get it done. I think that Edmonds and Connor are going to be more leaned on here for Arizona. But the pressure's on the Rams, who were built to win in the playoffs. Made all the trades to get their first rounders for the next 5 years to make deals, to get Matt Stafford, to get Von Miller, to get Jalen Ramsey, to get all these guys to make a run. They've got Sony Michel that was done a good job at running back down the stretch. Michel against the Niners last week, though, didn't have a good game. 21 carries, 43 yards. In fact, Michel has rushed for under 4 yards a carry each of the last two games. That number will go up playing Arizona, but all the pressure in the world is on Matt Stafford, who has thrown 8 interceptions in his last 4 games. He has thrown 7 in the last 3. For a guy that has Cooper Kupp and Odell Beckham Jr. and the weapons around him, that's inexcusable. And this is the guy trying to win his first playoff game of his career. And you can blame that he's with the Lions why he hasn't won one yet. But at some point, you have to get it done. And this is the kind of game that Rams fans, yes, Kelly Stafford, his wife, is saying, please, Rams fans, show up because otherwise it'll feel like a rogue crowd. But I don't want excuses if Matt Stafford screws up in this one. Because look at Stafford's numbers. In games that are decided by 7 points or less, 6 interceptions in that span. Since week 9, Stafford has thrown 13 picks. He threw 4 in the first 8 weeks of the season. So there is a little bit of pressure here for Matt Stafford to get it done. Now, against Arizona this year in 2 meetings, 5 touchdowns, 1 pick. So he's done a pretty good job there, completed 69% of his passes. I like Arizona on the road. I think they're more prepped for this. I think Kingsbury against McVay, it's really a toss-up. I know McVay's been to a Super Bowl, but it's tough to really trust either one of them because they both could go for gambles. They both can be creative. I mean, I've been burned by Kingsbury too many times. Remember, I said a few weeks ago that Arizona looked like the best team in the NFC. But they can play like it. Are you getting the Cardinals that were the dominant team for the first 2-3 months of the season? Or are you getting the Cardinal team that kind of wilted into the playoffs? Not sure what you're getting. And you're kind of not sure what Ram team you're getting either. Outside of the Jacksonville game, I mean, since the Arizona game, you look at the last 4 games the Rams have played. They struggled to beat Seattle. Matt Stafford threw 3 picks in Minnesota. Won by a point in Baltimore. They had to score a touchdown in the final minute. And then blew the lead to San Francisco at the end last week. In a game where they end up winning the NFC West, but they could have clinched it with a win. So kind of backing in the division necessarily. They have a lot to prove. And that's what makes this game fun. That's why I like it as number one game of the week. So we'll take a break. We'll do word association for the 6 games. We'll dive into it a little bit more in detail. Coming up next here on Kicking with Keeler on Full Press Radio. We'll be back after this. Getting set for wild card word association here on Kicking with Keeler. And if you're not familiar with the way we play the game and you're just new to the show, well, welcome. But here's how we play. I give out a matchup. We do the first word or phrase that pops into our head for each game. It gets a little bit tighter now. There's only 6 games instead of the 15 we're doing in different weeks, but we're going to do the best we can today. So let's start with the Saturday games this afternoon, and it's Vegas and the Bengals. And my word for this is pass rush, because if Vegas is going to win this game, and I do think ultimately the Bengals will prevail, it's going to be about, can Max Crosby and that Raiders pass rush get to Joe Burrow, who's been sacked over 50 times this season? They're going to have to make this ugly for Cincinnati, because if you give Burrow time, he's got Ja'Marr Chase, he's got T. Higgins, he's got Tyler Boyd, the occasional throw to C.J. Uzomah. He's got enough to make it happen. I think, though, what the Bengals can do, how you take away the pass rush, is you have a balanced attack. You get the ball to Joe Mixon, do what he did in that first matchup, like we talked about earlier, 30 carries, 123 yards, and a touchdown. If Mixon has that kind of game today, it's hard to imagine the Bengals not winning this game. There is no pressure on the Raiders. They really were not supposed to be here. It's been a fun story. There is pressure on Joe Burrow. Now, the Bengals will be viewed as a failure if they don't win, but this is a new stage. Both these teams have had long playoff droughts. Bengals haven't won a playoff game in over 30 years. Raiders haven't won a playoff game since they made it to the Super Bowl back in 2002. Basically the 2002-2003 season. But the Bengals are going to be the one with the expectation. There's not really expectation on Derek Carr. Not really expectation on the Raiders, who were left for dead about a few weeks ago. Beat Denver, beat Indy on the road, and then beat the Chargers at the end of the season. But now that Darren Waller is getting healthier, he becomes less of a decoy and more of a threat. So at least Carr has that option. One of the things you look at with Vegas this year is they were 5-3 away from home, and a lot of their more impressive wins were away from Vegas. They beat Pittsburgh on the road. They beat Dallas on the road. They beat Indy on the road. So they have good away wins. So don't count out Vegas in this game. I wouldn't be shocked if they won, especially if the Bengals, and you look at Zach Taylor on this stage as a head coach, does he make a decision that makes you go, huh? But I think the Bengals just have too much talent. I'm going to say they get the job done. To the nightcap, 8:15 on CBS, New England at Buffalo. And my word for this is ugly. Meaning if New England wants to win this game, it's got to be ugly. They're not going to win this game 31-28. If this game becomes anything of a track meet and a score fest, the Bills are going to win. Ultimately, I still think the Bills will win anyway. I, as a Patriot fan, I'm like 70-30, the Bills will win. Largely, I think there's more talent. I think they have a better quarterback. And when you have the conditions as ugly as they are, with the lack of temperature, take Josh Allen, albeit he has struggled in cold weather. Don't even look at the game in December with the wind. Go back to the game in Atlanta against the Falcons a couple weeks ago where it was snowing. He threw 3 picks. And what you want to do, again, if you're the Patriots, keep Josh Allen in the pocket. Make him throw the ball. Don't let him run around and get first downs. But when you get a 3rd and 7, and all of a sudden Allen finds the edge, he gets a first down, and you feel deflated. There's a New England team, though, that'll have Nelson Aguilar today. That'll have Kendrick Bourne healthy after he came back from COVID, really didn't do anything in the last matchup. That will get Hunter Henry more involved today. Jacoby Myers has played well in the last couple of weeks. So there are weapons for Mac Jones. But still, the Patriots, to win this game, have to run the ball, and their defense has to show up. And I'm calling out Matt Judon, who really hasn't done anything over the last few weeks after being a defensive player of the year candidate for the first 3 months of the year. New England's pass rush has to show up, because if they can't get to Josh Allen and can't make him throw the ball early, Stephon Diggs is going to light it up. As good as J.C. Jackson is, Diggs can get his advantages, as you saw a few weeks ago. And the number two corner, whether it's Miles Bryant, whether it's Jawan Williams, is going to get exposed. Again, New England's offensive line do just enough. Without Isaiah Wynn, you're going to probably see Justin Heron at left tackle. I would like to see Trent Brown there, but they haven't played him at left tackle all year long, although Brown is a left tackle. But more Michael and Wenyu at right tackle, because he's going to be used to provide the ground game. The Patriots will have success running the ball, because even in that loss a couple weeks ago, Damian Harris ran for over 100 yards and 3 touchdowns. But can Mac Jones make enough throws to get it done? There's going to be 3rd and 7s, 3rd and 6. If Mac Jones makes a decent percentage of them, they will win. I just don't think he's going to. So I'll take the Bills. I'll say it's like 23-20. If it's close, you like New England's kicking game with Nick Folk. Slightly over Tyler Bass. Folk's been money inside of 50 yards this year. But I think the Bills just have too much talent. Belichick will keep it close with his game plan. I just think the Bills are going to win. Sunday afternoon, Eagles at the Bucks, 1 o'clock on Fox. And my words for this is styles make fights. Number one rush offense, number one rush defense. Something's got to give. In this case, I'm going with the Tampa Bay rush defense. And one of the reasons I'm doing that, we didn't get into it earlier. The Eagles only have one win against a winning team this year. That was the Saints. So when Philly plays competition that's slightly above them, they don't exactly get the results. So how do you trust them on the road against the defending Super Bowl champions? You can't. Miles Sanders is coming back. He just had surgery a few weeks ago. And if Jalen Hurts has to throw the ball, I know Tampa's secondary is not the greatest, but who is Hurts exactly throwing it to? Dallas Goedert, Devontae Smith. I think Tampa has enough of a game plan to take them out of their rhythm. They took Hurts out of his rhythm plenty early on in the season. I just think it's hard for me to see the Bucks, albeit with the crazy rain and wind there, losing in their first game when they've been really good at home this year. Only one home loss, and that was to New Orleans, a team that historically plays them tough. To the 4:30 game on CBS, the Jim Nance Tony Romo special, the Nickelodeon special if you're watching with the kids too, the simulcast, Niners and the alternate cast, Niners at the Cowboys. My word for this is balance. Both these teams looking for balance offensively. For San Francisco, it's to make it life easier for Jimmy Garoppolo. And for Dallas, got to get Zeke Elliott involved, got to get Tony Pollard involved. Because if you do, that allows opportunity for play action. It allows more passes to Amari Cooper, to CD Lamb, to Dalton Schultz. Make life more comfortable for Dak Prescott. Don't make it to where everything's on his shoulders to win the game. And if you're the Niners, if you can run the ball and provide a balanced attack, you're not going to allow this Dallas defense to pin their ears back and come after Garoppolo with Gregory, DeMarcus Lawrence, Micah Parsons. Because if you do, it's going to lead to Trayvon Diggs getting an interception or two. I know everybody's been buying the 49ers, but when you see a trendy pick like that, you tend to go the other way. I'm going to take the Cowboys. Yes, I probably trust Shanahan more than I trust McCarthy. I just think being at home, the Cowboys are starting to find it a little bit. Now, they have had some stinkers at home, the Arizona game a couple weeks ago, the Vegas game on Thanksgiving. So the Cowboys have been a team that you can't really trust at home. Three of their five losses were in their own building this year. And how good are the Cowboys really when you consider half their wins are in the division? And the NFC East was a joke this year. I just think they've got barely enough. Again, another game I think comes down to the wire, but I'll take the Cowboys to beat the 49ers. It's a Sunday night game. Steelers at the Chiefs. My word for this is Ben's last stand. As I said earlier, I don't think the Steelers have enough offense to win this game. They need to play consistent offense for four straight quarters. When's the last time you've seen that? And if any turnover happens, the Chiefs can take advantage of a short field and be able to win the game. So give me Kansas City. I could see Pittsburgh covering. It's a big spread. But I like ultimately the Chiefs to get the win and advance, which would make it, if that happens, Chiefs-Bengals and... Oh no, Chiefs, Bills, Bengals, Titans, which would be a heck of a Final Four in the AFC if that happens. Finally, Cardinals, Rams in the NFC. My word for this is pressure. Kyler Murray really doesn't feel that much pressure. It is his playoff debut, but Matthew Stafford has the weight of the world on his shoulders this week, as I mentioned earlier. Struggled to have good ball control the last few weeks. He has done a good job against Arizona with limiting his ball limiting the ball control issues. But if the Rams don't bring a good balanced rushing attack with Michelle, and you're making Matt Stafford throw it, Arizona's going to get those turnovers. And the Cardinals have been a better road team this year than they are at home, so I'll take Arizona outright to get the win. So if that holds, your NFC matchups next week are going to be Tampa Bay against Dallas. Game is in Tampa Bay, but remember, Dallas almost beat the Bucks in week one. You could argue Dallas is a better team than at that point in the season. Remember, they couldn't even run the ball week one this year. So that would be a fun game. And Arizona-Green Bay, I think, would be an interesting game. Yes, the Cardinals would travel to cold weather, but if Arizona beats the Rams on the road and has 9 road wins this year, that's an interesting first game for Aaron Rodgers and the Packers, who would have had a week off, and Aaron Rodgers would have a week and about a half off. So it would be, I think it'll be a good divisional matchups nevertheless, but I think you're in for a really fun wildcard weekend this week. You got potential close games in Buffalo, potential close games in Dallas, potential close game against the Rams. And I think Vegas-Cincinnati has a chance to be a close one. I think the only lopsided ones are Tampa-Philly and Kansas City-Pittsburgh. But you can't doubt Mike Tomlin. I mean, Mike Tomlin's done one of his best coaching jobs this year, and it's a team playing with nothing to lose. Pittsburgh has heard it all week. They have no chance. I'm telling them they don't really have a chance. Crazy things have happened in the playoffs. Ask Pittsburgh last year when they got down 28-0 to Cleveland in the first quarter. You never know. So we'll take one more break. We'll come back, and we'll look back at the national championship. What went right for Georgia? What went wrong for Alabama? What's it mean going forward? And we'll talk about some other sports as well to wrap up the show. Final segment of Kickin' with Q, episode 126. Coming up next. Wrapping up Kickin' with Q, episode 126. You're in Full Press Radio. Again, thanks for tuning in on this Saturday before your playoff games start, and I hope you enjoy them this weekend. Let's talk about the national championship game that took place last Monday. We haven't been here since. Georgia with the upset. Now, I wouldn't say the upset. Georgia was favored over Alabama when you consider all the pressure around Georgia. They were hearing that they couldn't beat Alabama. The last two times they played them, there was ugly performances. Bama just dominated them. And Georgia took it to them. And you got to first start off with giving credit to Georgia before you start saying why Alabama lost the game, especially Stetson Bennett. Fourth quarter, he was absolutely outstanding. When Georgia needed to make plays, when Alabama got the fumble, took the lead 18-13 with 10-14 to go, it was like, okay, what is Stetson Bennett going to do now? Coming off a big turnover. And instead, he throws the 40-yard touchdown to Adonai Mitchell to give him the lead. Gets back down the field, the 15-yarder to Brock Bowers, the great tight end, to give Georgia the 8-point lead. And that was enough. And you look at the way Bennett performed down the stretch. What was the one thing he needed to do to beat Alabama? Not turn the football over. And yes, he had the fumble. But besides that, 17 of 26, 224 yards, 2 touchdowns, no interceptions. For a guy that all he had to do was simply manage the game and make the throws when he needed to, he did just that. Because he wasn't the prototypical quarterback that could beat a Nick Saban defense. He wasn't Trevor Lawrence. He's not Deshaun Watson. He's not any of those premier quarterbacks. But he's really been a guy that's defied the odds. When you think about his story, and it's been told over and over, but a walk-on that wanted to play at Georgia because he loved the university. A guy that a lot of people thought would eventually lose the job to JT Daniels, and they would bring in different recruits, and he could have easily went somewhere else and been a starter. And he was like, no, I want to be at Georgia. It's a school I love. And I think that's what, when you think about the transfer portal, you think about all these things in college football, you could embrace stories like that. A guy says, you know what, I want to stay here because I know I can win this job. So props to Stetson Bennett. Props to this Georgia rushing attack, 30 carries, 140 yards and a touchdown. Their defense, 4 sacks on Bryce Young, 9 tackles for loss, 8 pass deflections. They were in Bryce Young's face the entire night. And this is a Georgia defense that played with a chip on its shoulder. They had dominated Michigan a couple weeks ago in the playoff and in the Orange Bowl, and then they were basically saying, you know, we got a test of trying to beat the Heisman Trophy winner. And they were able to do that. And it's hard to blame Bryce Young, in a sense, for Alabama losing this game. I know Young went 35-57, 369, a touchdown. He did have the 2 picks. But look how Alabama's pass situation hurt them in this game. They already were without John Mechie. And then first half, Jamison Williams leaves the game, what ends up being a torn ACL. So you have Young playing essentially without not only one wide receiver, but without 2. And Williams had 4 catches for 65 yards, including a 40-yard catch earlier in the game. So when you take both of those guys away, that changes this Alabama offense, which really doesn't have that many playmakers on it. Brooks had stepped up down the stretch. Their tight end Cameron Latu had 5 catches for 102 yards. Before that game, he only had 1 catch in the prior 3. Now, guys will emerge. One of the things you know about a Nick Saban team is they'll eventually find weapons and they'll develop in the offseason. They'll become much better players. But for that point in the season, that's a lot to put on your Heisman Trophy winner against that defense to deliver. And the Alabama rushing attack didn't do what they did in Cincinnati. Brian Robinson had 22 carries for 68 yards, did not have a touchdown. And Georgia held him to 3 yards or a little bit more than 3 yards a carry in each game. It was about Georgia's defense taking the big play away from Bryce Young. And they did that. So what does this mean for both teams? For Georgia, they got the monkey off their back. They're now seen as one of the elite programs in college football. And it changes Kirby Smart's legacy. Remember, the curse of not beating Nick Saban as an assistant was lifted earlier this year when Jimbo Fisher did it. So now it's kind of the, I won't say the aura of invincibility has escaped Saban because he still has it. But Kirby Smart now can go in with that belief that, hey, I could beat him. I did it. Through all the misses Georgia had, the national championship when Tua threw the touchdown to Devontae Smith, all the SEC championship near misses for Georgia over the years, those are eradicated. And think about Atlanta sports that was seen as this cursed city, that was seen as a team that couldn't pull it off 28-3. The Braves for the Falcons. The Braves blowing a 3-1 lead to the Dodgers. They have a Brave team that's the World Series champions, Georgia who's the national champions, a Hawks team that made the conference finals in the NBA last year. So Atlanta all of a sudden becoming that emerging sports city again. So got to give them props and congrats to those Georgia fans. And for Alabama, look, Bryce Young's coming back next year. He's going to be in the mix to win back-to-back Heismans. They've got the transfer from Georgia Tech, Jamar Gibbs coming back, going to play running back. He's going to be dynamic. Can any of these wide receivers emerge to kind of help out Young now that Williams is going to the NFL? Mechie's gone. But Alabama's going to be a team that maybe relies more on their run game to help Young next year. Will Anderson's coming back. Probably the best defensive player in the country. Look, make no mistake, Alabama's going to be back in this position again. But now when you get to the playoff next year, if they do, Bryce Young will have all the pressure on his shoulders to win a national championship. So there's no disappointment. I know Alabama fans are going to be disappointed, but look, you made the championship game again. Nick Saban shows no signs of slowing down as a coach. They're going to be just fine. The other story this week, we talked about it last week. And there's a big hearing coming on Sunday morning in Australia about late tonight on the East Coast here in the United States is Novak Djokovic, who eventually it was ruled that he was allowed to play. He's in the draw technically as the one seed and supposed to play Monday. But his visa still ended up being revoked by the people in Australia. And there is still a chance Djokovic can be deported. And it's been a controversy that's gone on over the last week. A lot has happened. You've seen reports that Djokovic and his team lied about things on his visa. Stuff where he was reported that he knew about being testing positive and yet still did a photo shoot, which he regrets that he did. And you could tell when you look around the tour and you read some comments from some players. I mean, look at Rafa Nadal. He said this week, if he's playing, finally, okay. If he's not playing, the Australian Open would be a great Australian Open with or without him. That's my point of view. He also said, honestly, I'm a little bit tired of the situation. Stefanos Tsitsipas said, that's why I'm not here to talk about tennis. Not enough tennis been talked about in the last couple weeks, which is a shame. And you have Alex Stephen-Orr from Australia. This is from an ESPN article from the Associated Press. It feels like it's taking away from us competitors who just want to start. We're just eager to go out and compete. The Australian Open is always an incredible event. My home slam, my favorite tournament. Look, there was an easy solution for Novak. As he tries to now go to the higher court to get his visa approved and get to play. The easiest solution for him would be to just get vaccinated. And he wouldn't have been in that situation. Patrick McEnroe said on ESPN the other day, well, one of the only non-vaccinated players in this tournament is Novak Djokovic. And you could argue that both sides have really let this go. Djokovic could easily have maybe just said, you know what, I can't deal with this. And he's a strong guy. I mean, he's a guy that really is not loved by a lot of people. So he's used to being criticized and not being the fan favorite, because when he plays Nadal or Federer or Murray, the crowd usually roots for those three guys before they root for him. You could also blame the Australian government, who has let this drag on a long, long time, to the point where you had the draw ceremony Thursday postponed, and people thought it was because of Djokovic, and ended up Djokovic being the one seed, the tournament director is not answering any questions after the draw. We talked about this last week. It is clear the Australian Open could use Novak Djokovic just so people watch it. He would go for his 10th title, and there'd be drama around it. But if it's ruled that, hey, he can't play because he didn't get the vaccine, and you can't blame Australia, and you can't blame citizens of Australia for getting upset that they've been locked down in their country, and now this guy's allowed to play. When they've had to follow the rules, but he doesn't have to. So you can understand that. You have your opinion about the vaccine. We talk about that, and we're not going to get into that here. What matters is, I think this government, I think is the Australian government, has really made it a point to say, look, we can't make our people in our country this upset. The optic is bad. But Novak is going to try to play. We'll see if he does. If he doesn't, you've got guys like Medvedev and Tsitsipas that can win a slam. Tsitsipas looking to win his first slam. Nadal could possibly pass Djokovic in the race for who wins the most majors. And on the women's side, we'll see if Naomi Osaka can repeat. Good to see her back and competing in slams, but it's also wide open there. Can Ash Barty, the Australian, win at home? But you look at the women's draw, it's not a lot. I mean, there's a lot of mid-seeds that could make a run. Like, Halep is not a high seed as she used to be, and there's Garbine Muguruza could make a run. She's a good player. So the women's draw is always wide open. You don't have Serena Williams this year. Could Coco Gauff make a big push in Australia? We'll see. She made a good run to a recent tournament in the semifinals. There's a lot going on, and we'll recap it next week, what's gone on in the first week, because these matches happen late Sunday, late at night in the East Coast, and then early morning are the big primetime matches on Rod Laver Arena. But the Novak Djokovic drama is going to be looming over this tournament, at least in the first week. Because if Novak is ruled that his visa gets denied, then that's the talk of the first week, is did Australia make do the right thing, all that talk. If Novak is allowed to play, then every match Novak plays in gets magnified. Every match Novak plays in, you can tell there's frustration with him right now, and he's having trouble focusing, which is normal. And looming over potentially a 10th Australian Open title, every match he could get booed by the fans, even though, yes, it is half capacity in Melbourne. I would register to think, unless it's the pro-Serbian population, he's going to get booed in his matches that he plays. So how does Novak handle all that? But that the specter of that will loom over this tournament if Novak is in it. And it's a global story. I was watching a news channel the other day, they led with that story. So that's where the situation is, and that's how magnified it is. So again, thanks for tuning in today to Kicking with Keeler. I want to remind you can follow me on Twitter at RickNader555, and it's at R-A-C-K, letter I, Nader like a Terminator, 3 5s. Follow us on Twitter at FP_coverage, at Full Press Radio. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, or to your podcast, just search Kicking with Keeler, that's where you can find the show. I want to hear from you. Tell me what you like, what you don't like, and email me, rickjkeeler@gmail.com. Remember to download the Full Press Coverage app on your iOS or Android device. It is free. All of our articles are there. All of our podcasts are there. Live shows, including FBC NFL Sunday, which we will have live Sunday morning at 10 a.m. Myself, Braden Holacek, Ian Glendon, Kyle Senra. Ian Glendon runs the show on the site. We'll recap the two games today. We'll preview the other four games that take place over the weekend. Catch my team's work over at pinstripeprospects.com. A lot of good work by John Brophy, who got a chance to be on the conference call on Zoom for Rachel Balkovec, being introduced as the Yankees low-A manager for the Tampa Tarpons. That is a huge honor. Congrats to Rachel. She's earned it through her qualifications, through her resume. She's going to do great things, I'm sure, in the organization. But John got a chance to be a part of that. Eli Fishman's doing some great work for us. Be sure to check that out. You can catch my work over at Baird Sports Media. We had three articles go up this week. One was Ken Rosenthal was on the Brett Boone podcast on why he chose Fox over ESPN early on in his career, which I think about 2005. He's been at Fox for about 15 years. David Cohn was talking Sunday Night Baseball on his podcast and the excitement he has for it. And Michael Kay was on the Yes Network Curtain Call podcast, and he talked about how he views the K-Rod alternate broadcast Sunday Night Baseball and how he probably will not use Cia for his signature home run call because he said he's not going to really do play-by-play. He's going to let the main booth do that. Instead, it's going to be a talk conversations with Alex Rodriguez and any guests during the game, which I think it will work because when you look at Sunday Night Baseball, unless your favorite team is playing, you're not that invested in it. So if that is the case, then you're going to want to just hear conversations and A-Rod talk about baseball and not be scripted and just have fun with it. So that's where it can work, those 8 to 10 games that they do. So we'll be back next week. We will look ahead to divisional round. We will look back at wildcard weekend. If any coaching hires get made, we'll discuss those. We'll get into some more college basketball and the NBA. We didn't get really a chance to do that this week. We'll do that more next week. And we'll have some fun along the way and do some Australian Open updates as well. From all of us here at Full Press Coverage, I'm Ricky Keeler saying thanks for kicking it with me, Ricky Keeler, on a Saturday. Enjoy your playoff weekend, and I will see you back here next time.